in terms of disruption and state response, it was probably the most significant or impacting action done by civilians in terms of its immediate consequences of the Irish Army being deployed to Shannon and making overt, what was covert, the militarisation of that airport. Three US companies who were transporting troops through Ireland to Iraq pulled out of Ireland over security issues in relation to the action. So it was a very, probably the most dramatic, disruptive.
Let's be clear about exactly what the five of you did. What exactly did you
do? We made our way into the hangar by breaking a window and using the emergency bar on the initial door, and then opening the next door, and then began working on the plane. And after completing our work, about 6 or 7 minutes, we formed a circle. We built a shrine with the Bible and a Quran, rosary beads and Islamic beads, and photos of Iraqi children under threat. And we also said the rosary, and hoped that the police would join us, you know, in continuing the disarmament, but that didn't happen, unfortunately. We were arrested and taken to prison. We were in Limerick prison for between 1 and 3 months. Karen spent 3 months in jail. We were inspired by a prophecy in the book of Isaiah to beat swords into plowshares. And every action, I think, one does has an actual and a symbolic element to it. And I believe it's the symbolic element that is most significant, because the actual part of the action is the relationship between two pieces of metal, the hammer and the plane, where the symbolic element to the action is what speaks to hearts and minds of other people. So it's continued to ripple, like we still remain unconvicted for the action, and a major headache for the Irish government in terms of its sycophancy to the United States.
And I was thinking another symbolism was the fact that you, the five of you, were prepared to give your lives, your freedom, for instance, so that maybe other people might not have to suffer, but maybe that's probably another unintended consequences or something, maybe not.
Well, it's a very, I mean, the biggest gift we're given is our lives, and second to that is our freedom. So it's a big gift for people to offer. And since we acted, we haven't been completely free. We've been on bail for 3 years, and three of us were not from Ireland. We're from the diaspora. So Karen was from Scotland, Ewan was from the States, and I was from Australia. So it has been a long haul, but it's, you know, we try and put that in the context of how long the war in Iraq has been going as well.
So apparently there was supposed to be a lot of security in Shannon at the time of your action, because of that same plane that you attacked happened to be attacked a few days earlier.
Yeah, the plane was engaged, I guess, by Mary Kelly, on a Wednesday, and there were photographs of special branch officers with Uzis around the planes before we acted. So security had been stepped up. And on the Friday night, on the Late Late Show, the Transport Minister got on in response to Mary's action, said, look, we've learned from our mistakes, the area is totally secure. And the plane was completely repaired on Sunday evening, and we disabled it again on Monday morning. So it was quite a sequence of events. Then Haas arrived on the Monday morning, and as the peace emissary to Northern Ireland that Bush had sent over, and he was a former UN ambassador to the UN when the first Gulf War was on. So he was furious, and it's kind of interesting to, like, compare and contrast Bertie and Cowan's response as Haas's fury, and there is actually TV footage of it, and they really look like despondent schoolboys getting a dressing down from the headmaster. And you contrast that to Ahern's response to 100,000 people marching in Dublin, and him, you know, cynically saying, I'm happy to see so many people supporting the government's policy on the war. So, you know, it did rock his socks a bit, you know.
So sovereignty is a myth.
It's a joke, you know, and it's amazing that so many political parties over here define themselves in one form of nationalism or another. And, you know, it's a joke. Like, they haven't got an independent foreign policy. They've now got a US base in County Clare.
It's been two trials so far. Can you tell us, okay, the action took place in February 2003. Mm. The five of you were tried in March 2005. And again in October 2005. So can you tell us about the first trial? Was straightforward. The judge, what happened?
Yeah, I mean, initially we could have gone to trial in June of 2003 in County Clare and Kilrush, which is a very small town, and we made an application to get a fair trial. We should be taken out of the area that is economically dependent on the airport. And it's rarely given that kind of change of venue application these days in Ireland, and we were granted it. And that brought us to Dublin, which was a much more significant site for the trial in terms of the government and the US embassy and et cetera. So that kind of delayed the case. We were then granted by the judge who was handling our pre-trial hearings discovery. It was fairly broad discovery. It was what was on the planes that passed through Shannon. And the government didn't want to give that up, either because, one, they're so sycophantic, they didn't know, they hadn't bothered checking any of the planes and haven't been informed about what was on them, or two, they just didn't want us to know and the public to know. So they put in a judicial review, and that slowed the process down quite a bit right through, you know, went right through 2003 and 2004, so we finally came to trial in 2005. For a whole year, we were banned from County Clare and had to sign on every day, and then it became twice a week, and presently it's once a week, and they're a bit more flexible now about us leaving the country. So
the trial happened in March 2005.
Five, that's correct, and the judge we had, you know, when I gave my testimony, and I was the only one to give testimony before the trial collapsed. And the first seven objections to my testimony came from the judge, which isn't his job, and rather than the prosecutor. And when the prosecutor made an objection, the judge said, I've been waiting for you. And then he made a technical error, a legal error, by ruling out our defence, which we had a legitimate defence under Irish law, damaging property with a reasonable excuse, which is to preserve the life or property of another person.
1991 Criminal Damages Act.
That's right, and he ruled on that without hearing legal argument, which is illegal, really. So that when that was pointed out to him over the course of the weekend, he decided that the case had been compromised due to perceived prejudice, or possible perceived prejudice, and put a gagging order on that being reported, which kind of became moot once our second trial collapsed. The second trial went the full course, nearly. Everyone gave a testimony. And also other people like Jimmy Massey, a veteran of this war, Kathy Kelly, who was in Baghdad during the bombing, and Dennis Halliday, and others. So right at the end of the trial, the judge went to make a legal ruling on a defence where he made a fairly, you know, what we thought was an improper ruling, that he wasn't going to let the jury entertain the possibility that we may have had a lawful excuse. We felt that the jury should be the ones to decide that. And he was going to rule that we didn't have a lawful excuse. So at that point, we confronted the judge with his own history, that he'd been had met President Bush when he was governor of Texas, that he'd been invited to inaugurations.
He was invited by Tom DeLay, head of the House of Representatives, who turned out to be in trouble.
Formerly head, he's on corruption charges now. So, yeah, all that was very interesting, and we argued that that would be perceived prejudice, and that, you know, maybe he should never have taken the case in the first place. So after some deliberation, he pretty much agreed to that, and the case collapsed. So we've been given a July 5th date for 2006.
When that collapse happened, you had some indication which way the jury would have gone, didn't you?
Yeah, I didn't immediately go outside. I mean, jury didn't know I'd collapsed, but about seven or eight of them apparently expressed solidarity and support and affirmation. Whether that would have been the case after closing arguments where we didn't have anything to say in closing and the prosecutor could have ranted on for an hour and a half or two, whether that those numbers would have held, but it was most likely we would have got a hung jury at least, if not acquitted.
But there was a nice personal touch, wasn't there?
Yeah, I got a Christmas card from one of the jury, yeah.
You've been in Ireland since, I think, 2002, and since your action in February 2003, you first had to contend with the government, who you were saying it was Dermot Ahern prejudiced your trial.
It was a Minister of Transport and Minister of Defence who said on media that we had assaulted and hospitalised a member of the Garda Síochána who was in the hangar during the action. And, you know, when that guard got up twice now in court on oath, he said that we comforted him while he had a stress attack. And, you know, those government ministers made those prejudicial remarks on the media and they've never been retracted.
there was definitely non-violent action anyway. But despite what the government were obviously against you, and despite what was going on in Shannon Airport, how were you treated by the left or by just people generally speaking in Ireland?
Well, I guess the authoritarian left and the moderate left, who were running a fairly big anti-war campaign at that stage, 100,000 people marched within 2 weeks of us doing the action. And they did not mention us from the stage, you know, or call for support for us while we were in prison. Their objective was to marginalise us. And I'm not sure what the reason was. I suspect is that, you know, that they basically saw the war as a marketing opportunity for their political groups, that they weren't that serious about opposing the war. And they saw us as some kind of political competitors, which we hadn't, you know, neither the interest or the resources to compete with running the anti-war movement in Ireland. The people who were running it, both the authoritarian left and the moderate left, were very much against the politics of direct action. And might be outside their comfort zone. Now, I was quite surprised how few people were willing to be arrested against this war in Ireland. You know, there was just, I don't know, maybe 50 or 60, I think, you know, considering there's 900 troops going through Shannon every day and they're willing to risk their lives and legs and arms and sanity to prosecute the war. The people who were willing to risk peril or arrest and loss of liberty were quite few in number. There wasn't, the people who did risk arrest, there wasn't much ritual for supporting them either. A lot of them were left quite isolated. A lot of our support came from Catholic worker communities in the United States and our international contacts.
Yeah, now this could be seen especially around the times of your two trials, especially the first one. But now I know you tried to rally people around that as well. And you also do vigils at the Aviation Authority building in Dublin, and you mark certain anniversaries like the Hiroshima bombing. And so these vigils are there all the time to try to mark symbolic dates and events as well. But is there a question about the apathy of people generally? Do you feel isolated in a world where people just have handed over they let other people make their minds up for them, and their thoughts are presented to them every day in newspapers and media which ignore you?
Yeah, we would have, over the last 3 years, we probably would have had about a dozen people who were like seriously committed to being in solidarity with us, ranging from, you know, musicians who put on gigs and others who'd supply transport and solidarity and finances and stuff. People are very disengaged. You know, I think the technique for social control now is a lot more advanced than when I was growing up 20 years ago. And I don't know, in Ireland there's a kind of a culture of resignation as well. I don't know if that's true with the weather or not.
Post-colonial angst.
That's right. You know, it's a bit... there's a deep scepticism in the culture, which can flip into cynicism quite easy, and cynicism is an easy way to avoid one's responsibilities, really. And people confuse it with being wise and sophisticated.
So it's not a culture of risk-takers, then?
Well, definitely not now. It might have been 20 years ago, I'm not sure. But it's very materialistic, and it's very strange. I haven't quite worked it out. I've been here. It might not be that different to Australia when I go home, really. But
things get more globalised, don't they, anyway?
Yeah, I think a lot of us who grew up in the diaspora had, you know, a pretty romantic view of Ireland in terms of resistance and solidarity and not, you know, taking any shit from the empire and all that kind of stuff. And there are those traditions still in Ireland. I mean, I grew up very much with consciousness about being Irish, and probably one does that more so outside of Ireland than in it. I mean, we experienced quite a bit of prejudice for having Irish names, etc., and, you know, I would have grown up in the Irish community in Brisbane and gone off to Cayleys and music nights and stuff. And my father is from Clara in County Offaly, and my grandfather, you know, was part of the War of Independence and was actually on the run in North America, and I ended up in the same jail as him 70 years after he was in there in Albany, New York. So all those kind of radical anti-imperial traditions were handed down. So, yeah, it was quite interesting running to Damien Moran, who's from the same county as my father, and doing this action with them. And his father actually had a mutual friend of my father, which is quite amazing. So it's been interesting to live in Ireland, kind of deconstruct. You know, it's as racist to romanticise the culture as is to demonise it, whether it's Irish or East Timorese or Aborigines or whatever. But it's important to understand your culture, and culture is there. You know, Irish culture is in North America, and it's in Britain, and it's in Australia, and it's in Argentina, and it's you can't dismiss it with a kind of plastic patty kind of approach. You know, people are enculturated, and it's important to see the strengths and weaknesses of your culture.
One of the traditions is that Offaly is called the Faithful County.
Is it really? Should know that. But so, you know, this group are being sentenced next week. Three of them are from the same family, the Gradys, and they're very much Irish Americans. And I found it very easy to relate to Irish Americans when I was in the States in the Catholic Worker Movement and the Resistance Movement. And, you know, so they acted on St. Patrick's Day, the St. Patrick's Day 4, in their occupation military recruitment centre. So if Ireland did speak out with some clarity and integrity on this war, it'd have huge ramifications amongst the diaspora in Australia and the States and Britain. And I don't think Irish people realise that. They kind of see themselves as small and insignificant, where it's a very strong cultural terms of reference. And that doesn't have to all be spent on making tourist dollars. You know, it can be spent, you know, waged or wielded in ways of political and moral integrity.
And maybe they're afraid of selling their social capital.
Maybe. That's why the Taoiseach will be there with his imperial tithe of a bowl of shamrocks on St. Patrick's Day in the White House.
Yeah, maybe some Irish are more interested in capital than social capital.
That's right. You got pretty high opinion ratings today, Bertie, huh?
Is that right?
No. Growing in popularity. It's just very... There's no leadership at all, you know, from the churches or political parties in relation to the war. It's just very cowardly and following trends, and it's hardly anywhere in civic society where the reality of 900 troops going through Shannon to kill and be killed in Iraq is being seriously addressed in the media or the churches or academe or the union movement.
Subculture,
you know.
330,000 troops went through last year, wasn't it?
Yeah, most of the troops who would have been killed in Iraq would have touched down at Shannon, people like Casey Sheen, you know. Was there on the 20th of March last year, I think, and then was dead a week later in Baghdad. And his mother was with us here in December. So it makes it very real when you meet the people who've lost people. And I guess the Catholic worker is always doomed. You know, as Daniel Berrigan would say, start small and get smaller. It is this kind of prophetic minority, and it is a vocation, you know, and it's about how to live one's life with integrity, how to be faithful, rather than successful, and which I guess was always a big theme for me. You know, I'm 45 and I missed the 60s, people who were 18 and 68 are 10 years older than me. So I had this feeling when I was growing up, I'd missed this radical period, and I also wondered what happened to all these people, and did they sell out, and why did they sell out? And so the kind of consciousness of selling out or being compromised has always been a big part of my psyche, given the age that I am, you know, post-1960. So.
But apart from the Catholic worker and people who are faith-based, I mean, there is a question of trying to involve people to basically get them to have faith in themselves and to resist. And resistance doesn't necessarily have to take direct action, even though if everybody decided, or if a lot of people decided to take more direct actions than Shannon, the war would be made far more difficult for the United States. But what other ways can people resist?
Yeah, you hook up with people, you know, what you do is hook up with radicals in every tradition, whether they're Buddhists or young anarchists or whatever, you know, and I believe on the basis of democracy and non-violence and direct resistance, and so it's not our attempt to convert anyone to our tradition. You know, most of our energy is into challenging people in our tradition to be true to it. It's not about trying to recruit more people and to be supportive of other people in other traditions, you know, doing their thing. You know, people need to, you know, we've basically been atomized as private consumers rather than citizens. People need to break out of that whatever way they can, move from being a passive consumer to an active citizen.
When you mentioned Casey Sheehan there, and it was Rose Gentle, Cindy Sheehan came here, they've taken the sons of their deaths, and they've had faith in themselves now, and they've taken the issue forward to their respective governments. But also there's whistleblowers as well, isn't that?
Yeah, a lot of significant resistance is coming out of the military and the military families now. But there have been people like Ed Horgan and Tim Horrigan who did a lot of consistent work around the flights going through Shannon, both the military and the CIA flights. So, yeah, I think your culture of nonviolent resistance and solidarity with those who are before the courts or arrested or in jail is basic to a serious movement, because a serious movement needs to confront power. You know, it can't dance around it or talk forever around it. It always needs, if it's going to have any integrity, some of their number to actually put their bodies on the line and say, no, we believe non-violently.
So for those who feel they've nothing to offer really practically, solidarity is the very least anyway.
Yeah, I mean, there's not much resistance because there's not much solidarity. And resistance is easier the more solidarity you have, you know. And so...
You're taking a break from it all now. Has it been difficult, the isolation?
It has been in some ways, yeah. You know, I'm kind of in exile from my movement. My movement's mostly North America, and I'm banned from North America. So I'm kind of in exile from my elders and my tradition and this kind of movement. No, I don't think any of the five of us thought would drag out this long before we had a decision. And we came together quite rapidly. We came together 8 days before we did the action, which isn't ideal. Usually a Ploughshares group prepares seriously for 6 months. So it's been a really interesting time. The other four people are all very different and very courageous and have a lot of integrity, and no one regrets the action. I'm pretty tired about organising around it without a kind of general anti-war movement existing in Ireland. So I've kind of decided, three of the others have already left the country, that I'll go home for 3 months and connect with my family, then come back a bit more refreshed to do the third trial and and possibly a fourth trial. You know, if we get a hung jury, I believe that the Irish government, under direction of the US government, will put us on trial for a fourth time. So
I was going to ask you, are you hopeful? But obviously you can see a long path ahead of you.
You never know. I was in that courtroom in 96 when the Liverpool jury found the four women not guilty of £2.5 million worth of criminal damage, you know. It was great, you know, the integrity of that jury, so...
And if you are found not guilty, it'll have incredible ramifications, not just for the extraordinary renditions that are going through Shannon, but maybe even for its use as a war port itself.
Yeah, if we're found not guilty, it's really a reflection on the quality of conscience of those 12 people, you know, rather than our great technique or anything. And it'll be a great message to send to London, D.C. and to the Dáil.
Kieran Riley, thank you very much.
Thank you.